So we're starting today with here, O Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are not produced or stopped, not defiled or immaculate, not deficient or complete. So far the sutra has dealt with the five skandhas. But now we're progressing to all dharmas. All dharmas comprises 72 conditioned plus 3 unconditioned dharmas. The unconditioned dharmas, the 3 unconditioned dharmas were space, nirvana with substratum, and nirvana without substratum. Now this is according to early schools of Buddhism. Nirvana with substratum was the period between the Buddha's enlightenment and his parinirvana, when he was still subject to the five skandhas. But without substratum was after his parinirvana, when it was only pure enlightenment then. So, all dharmas comprises 72 conditioned and 3 unconditioned. But to understand dharmas, we need to refer to the Abhidharma. The production of the Abhidharma by various early schools of Buddhism, including the Sarvastivadin school, to which the sutra is referring. There was an attempt to systematize and analyze all that exists in the conventional world, that is, into its ultimately existent elements. And they call these ultimately existent elements dharmas, not to be confused with dharma as the teaching of the truth, but as dharmas. In other words, something like phenomena. These dharmas were considered to be ultimately real, irreducible, in that they were not compounded, they were not made up of parts, in other words. Dharmas aren't things, actually. They're not things like a table or a dog or a TV. They're happenings, events, facts, etc. In the text, produced, stopped, defiled, immaculate, deficient, complete, are examples of the dharmas that were seen to be ultimately existent. They were seen to be irreducible, uncompounded, having inherent existence. According to the Abhidharma, they were said to arise, abide momentarily, and cease. So, quite important to get this. These were the early school. The Sarvastivadins arrived at 75 dharmas. The Theravadins arrived at, I think, something like 128, was it? Something like that. But they were all after the same thing, trying to find what was ultimately existent. The elements of the five skandhas that were ultimately existent. In fact, it was kind of looking for the fundamental building blocks, if you like. But the sutra here is refuting this when it declares that all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are not produced or stopped, not defiled or immaculate, not deficient or complete. It's saying that the dharmas are marked with emptiness and they can therefore have no other mark, no other designation. If they're empty, they can't be marked with any other designation. Because ultimately, according to this, they don't come into existence. They don't come into ultimate existence. We okay on that? The idea of it. They were looking for these ultimately existent elements of the five skandhas.
Well, it begs the question, why they did that? If Buddhism says that there's no things having a self-nature, what on earth would they do looking for self-nature?
Well,
got something wrong, didn't they?
Yeah, well, apparently all of the early schools actually did this.
Did they? Yeah.
Investigating analysing the five skandhas to try to determine ultimately existent elements.
Strange.
As I say, the sutra here is refuting it when it says that all dharmas are marked with emptiness. There are no dharmas that have ultimate existence, inherent existence.
I suppose you have to look, don't you? I mean, you really have to look. As soon as you say it doesn't exist, you go, well, really? Does it? Sure. And I suppose there would be a point in not necessarily just in practice taking it as read. And once you started asking the question, there becomes a kind of momentum set up that might actually do it. Well, maybe they're, you know, really looking for, the mind then wants to find something.
Well, it is a bit contradictory to the Buddha's own statement that all, everything is an Atman, without self, without soul. But after his death, they seem to want to investigate it and determine it's actually to try and break down what the skandhas were composed of in a way. Mm. And to determine if there was anything existent in them. And they looked on them, of course, as I said, that a dharma arises, abides momentarily, and ceases. That it just momentarily comes into existence and ceases. These are the existent, inherently existent dharmas.
It's very attractive, that, isn't it? Because it, as a thought, it's quite attractive because we see that that's an experience that we have. We see things there. And yet it's only when you look again and ask, well, what is the nature of that ceasing? Are they existing while they're ceasing? Are they not existing while they're ceasing? How do you know they're ceasing? Do you know they're ceasing because of this moment or because you look back? You know, how do you know at the moment you're looking at that something is actually ceasing?
If you really think of it, that everything was flowing in that sort of way, that a dharma abided momentarily and then ceased. Mm. Now, the cessation would be instantaneous, otherwise it's a process. And the coming into to abiding is instantaneous, or it would be a process. So really what you would have then is an instantaneous change abiding, instantaneous change abiding. So you would have a continuum of abiding, which would be, in fact, it would be a continuum of moments of abiding, which would make a sort of hiccuping life in a way.
One thing there to remember is, you know, it's like actually the view that things have substance is very, very compelling. Otherwise, we wouldn't struggle so much with this stuff. Yeah. And what the Buddha was trying to teach would be easy. Mm. You know, so, I mean, in a way, it's like we can talk glibly about emptiness, but actually we're trapped in a view of substantiality.
Yes, well, as soon as you put that, that's what this is denying, you see. As soon as you put a label on anything, a designation, you're giving it substance. You're giving it a degree of permanence. And it's the basis of all suffering.
That's right. It's the compelling view that we all subconsciously subscribe to, though, isn't it? You know, so in a way, as we're addressing it, it's quite hard to shift that view.
Yeah.
But what's the current Theravadin view? Do they this is Mahayana.
This is Mahayana, yes. Well, presumably they still have this view of a dharma arises, abides momentarily, and ceases. You come across it in quite a lot of Pali texts. Or at least you'll come across it in Pali texts, if not quite a lot. That a dharma arises, abides momentarily, and ceases. Yes, but I have read Theravadin monks who were agreeing with the insubstantiality of it. So if they agree with insubstantiality, then they presumably aren't seeing any abiding.
Does this mean, in a sense, that they weren't taking the Buddha's word for it? I mean, it suggests, you know, this is where faith comes in, I suppose, because they couldn't prove those ultimate existent elements any more than they could prove enlightenment exists. You know, this is not scientific analysis, is it, by experiment? This is them just thinking it out, and in the same way that the Greeks went for the model of you didn't have to experiment, you just kind of thought it out, you know.
Well, the whole arising of the Mahayana was actually in protest at this analysis of the Abhidharmic view. That's sort of the first Perfection of Wisdom Sutras came in.
Right.
The 8,000 lines came in.
And well, when was that in time?
The 8,000 lines, I think, was in the first century before the current era, BC.
Oh, right. Okay.
BC. There is the view that the Buddha actually did teach this, but that it was a more or less a secret teaching because it wasn't considered that they were ready for it at that period, that it was in existence and only resurfaced with the Perfection of Wisdom when people were ready for it. That probably mythological, but it's often put forward.
But you've got to think of the culture that the Buddha was teaching, and he made a strong culture of the Atman doctrine, didn't he? Because that's what the Buddha would have been brought up with.
Yeah,
sure. It would have been a really strong culture.
It's like Nike was saying, we've just got this very strong perception of I'm solid. Everyone else must be solid, you know. Therefore, let's try and find this ultimately irreducible path.
Yeah.
It seems quite strong in human nature just to do that, doesn't it? Yeah.
Also, of course, we have to label things. And although that gives them a kind of permanence, it's necessary to do it, to live in the conditioned world, to survive in conditioned existence.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we've never to lose sight of the conventional truth.
Mm.
It is our experience. It's conventionally true. That's the idea of the two truths. And if you don't see the two truths and acknowledge the two truths, you're missing. You're missing emptiness. You're missing Pratitya Samuppada. You can't have an ultimate truth without the conventional truth. So you must never lose sight of the conventional truth, or think that by saying that it's empty, that it does not exist conventionally.
But would it be true to say that the view of Atman, that there is no self, no soul, would it be right in saying that that's more of a refinement of, sorry, an Atman? Would that be right to say that it's more of a refinement? There is no soul. Only in that the self is always changing, or everything always changes, as opposed to the soul being an unchangeable entity that would come in from life to life.
Yes, that's right. The view of the time that the Atman was something fixed. It was a fixed soul. In fact, they reputedly explored their whole body to try and point out where this Atman resided, whether it was in the heart or in the chest or in the various points in the body, that it was something that went on from, but it was reincarnated. That was the idea of reincarnation, as quite different from the Buddhist point of view of the re-becoming of Pratitya Samuppada, karma. You know, that everything arises in dependence and conditions, that there's nothing fixed at all. Everything is just conditions, just a series of conditions. That's the karmic view of it. But the Atman view was that there was something fixed. And I mean, it was discussed whether it was the size of a pea or what size it was and all sorts of ridiculous things that was reincarnated. But that's what the Buddha refuted with an Atman, no Atman.
Mm-hmm.
All there is Pratitya Samuppada. Everything arising in dependence and conditions. So in a way it would be wrong to say that Buddhism believes in reincarnation. It's not reincarnation of what? It isn't.
Mm.
It is just a process of becoming Pratitya Samuppada. Reincarnation, as I said, was this idea that there is something fixed, inherent within us, wherever it resides, that is reborn again and again, or is reincarnated again and again, until it becomes, it's purified and becomes one with the Godhead or something, it's something like that. But the Buddhist idea is just that everything arises in dependence and conditions. So, if you look at it from that point of view, Buddhism would say that at the point of death, there is a condition. You could see it as the culmination of all the conditions of a lifetime that are at that point of death. And in dependence on that, the rebirth arises. It's not you that would be reborn, and it's not entirely not you. It's the conditions that create the arise, or the arising is dependent on the conditions. I'm going to pick it up again. You mentioned yesterday about abiding, how it had influenced me a great deal, because when I came across that idea of a dharma arises, abides momentarily, and ceases. It was before I had really studied it, and I reflected on it, and I thought, it's puzzled me. I just can't follow this at all. And the idea that arose in me was that if a dharma abides momentarily, no matter how brief a period of time a moment is, it has a degree of permanence. A moment is a measure of time. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And if a dharma abides momentarily, that middle of its abiding is substantial. It's a self. It's inherent. It would mean that it's something inherently existent in that moment of abiding. So I thought, well, that doesn't make sense at all. So, it just doesn't agree with just what we've been discussing, what the Buddha said. There is no Atman, there is nothing permanent within us at all. So, it's that everything is without self. So, the Dharma, a Dharma that abided momentarily would have a self, would have an Atman. So, I thought, right, if a Dharma doesn't abide even momentarily, then the only conclusion that I could reach with it, if there was no abiding whatsoever, then that every Dharma, or every phenomenon, if you like to put it that way, arises and ceases simultaneously. Follow? Mm-hmm. Something doesn't abide, then there's no degree of permanence. Then the only conclusion you can reach is that a dharma or a phenomenon arises and ceases, and ceases and arises simultaneously. If it's a flow, there is no degree of permanence, then there is nothing fixed at all. There's a flow of dharmas, but every dharma must be arising and ceasing simultaneously. So a dharma never ultimately comes into, or a dharma doesn't ultimately come into existence. It just flows. The simultaneous. There was, just as an aside, when I reflected on this at the time, I thought, well, if it arises and ceases simultaneously, in that moment of change, if you like, that instant of becoming, you couldn't say that the Dharma is that which is arising or that which is ceasing. There'd be no way of determining whether it was the Dharma that was arising or the Dharma that was ceasing, and the simultaneous arising and ceasing. So what's the true nature of that instant of becoming? It would seem that there's really nothing you can say about it. It's empty, isn't it, of any definition. You can't say anything about it. silence. When I tried to put this, when the first time I after thinking about it, reflecting on it and thinking about that, I did get a sort of blank stare from the person who was doing it, and I tried to think of an analogy that might make it clear. And it might and it might not, but let me try it on you. Imagine, and the only relevant point in this is the instant of change. The rest of it is just supposed to be. Imagine a heap, okay? A heap of, say, 4 coins. If a 5th coin is placed on the heap, in the very instant that that 5th coin becomes part of the heap, in that very instant of change, of what is the heap constituted? In that very instant that the 5th coin becomes part of the heap, is the heap, is it still a heap of 4? Or is it a heap of 5? Or would you say, in that very instant, it's a heap of both 4 and 5? Or perhaps you'd say, no, it's neither of these two alternatives. Because if you say it's 4, you've still got to say, well, when is it going to be 5? And if you say, well, it's 5, then when did it cease being 4? And the same applies if you say, oh, in that instant it's both 4 and 5. Well, when is it going to stop being 4 and become 5? And if you say it's neither, well, what is it? Do you see that you can't say that in that instant, you can't say it is not, or it both is and is not, or that it's neither of these alternatives. That instant is indefinable. It's empty of anything that can be said about it. And that's how everything is. Remember that that's one instant we're looking at in the flow of phenomena. That's how everything is. That's how the universe is. In that reflection, another thought arose, thinking of that simultaneity, which at the time I thought, oh, this is an interesting aside. But if a dharma or a phenomenon arises and ceases simultaneously, and that's how everything is, then in the simultaneity, there's no before and no after. There's no forward and no back, no reverse, up, down, anything. So the thought arose, well, that indefinable emptiness is not limited in time or space at all.
The only way I can grasp this is to take as the supposed time is an invention. The only way I can justify that comment is that in saying that arising and ceasing happens simultaneously, the Buddha must be saying that time is non-existent.
Well, it isn't.
Is that the lesson that the Buddha's given here?
Well, no, it's not. That was my reflection just. And I just thought when it came up, this is an interesting aside that has arisen in my reflection. Mm-hmm. But later on, I had reason to think that I could relate something to it, and we'll come to that later on, maybe tomorrow. We're going to look at Nagarjuna, and he does an examination of time and space. And he says, well, it's a rather detailed examination, but the conclusion is that time is dependent. It arises in dependence, that it is a relationship. Purely a relationship. Time isn't an entity. It isn't something. It only arises in dependence and conditions. It is a relationship between events. In other words, it's a relationship between the time we got up this morning and the time we're sitting here. These two events. And space, he said, the same thing, roughly. Space is simply a relationship a relationship between the ceiling and the floor, if you like. It isn't an entity, it has no substance. It's pratitya samutpada. It arises in dependence upon conditions. The conditions that there's a ceiling there, there's a floor there. It's a relationship between these two. It isn't anything in itself. It doesn't have inherent existence, neither does time, according to the Gaja.
You starting off, you were talking about simultaneous arising and ceasing. Now, I find it much easier to address this in terms of the nature of consciousness. If I look at the nature of my mind and my experience, then that is the simultaneous arising and ceasing. The lack of substance feels easier to get a grip on. But I still don't understand why things appear to have substance. Why is this compelling, apparent, substantial nature to objects?
I suppose why is a very un-Buddhistic word.
Isn't it? That's kind of my experience. On the one hand, I think,
it just does.
I'm trying to think of a non-rude word to say that. I think, well, how can it be? You know, how can it be that objects appear to have substance if what they're composed of is simultaneously arising and ceasing?
Yeah. So I don't know.
It's like David said in the film. You see a film in front of you, but the screen's blank in between each frame that's shown. And yet we see it as a constant motion.
So there's a lot of inference goes on there, isn't there?
You can't be forward.
Yeah.
Why? It's because we want to make it permanent. Yeah. We want to make permanent what is transient. Because we want to repeat the experience, or we want to reject the experience and cling to what is. We want to make it substantial.
There's an element of kind of... why do things appear to be so substantial if it's true that actually it's all about this momentary arising and ceasing? I can see in the nature of consciousness, I can see it from a different perspective, it makes more sense. But when I try and go into the material, I find it much more difficult to.
I don't think the reason is a material one. I think the reason is attachment. Rather than anything to do with how matter appears, or our ability to perceive and apprehend. I think the filling in that we do is attachment.
I looked at it in that way as well, as that sense of attachment. When if I attach to something, there's an I attached to it, so I can infer my own existence from my attachment. So, if you see what I'm saying, just by the presence of aversion thank you. That's the other thing about my aversion. Is that at the end of that tethering is an I being inferred.
Yes.
And if I'm pissed off, there's an I that's being pissed off. Do you mean, at least I exist. If I'm pissed off, I exist. And if I really want something, I exist. And they're the two states. And that infer my own existence, which is, of course, the biggest fear I have, is that I don't exist.
Well, the fundamental insight of the Buddha was that everything arises in dependence upon conditions. In Sanskrit, that's pratitya samutpada. It's translated in various ways as conditionality, dependent arising. And by consorts, conditioned co-production. I always wonder just what exactly that meant. Co-production. However, but let's look at what we've been talking about from the point of view of conditioned co-production or dependent arising. Take a dharma or a phenomenon as a condition, in dependence upon which a phenomenon arises. In the very instant that the phenomenon arises, it's a condition, in dependence upon which a phenomenon arises, and the very instant that phenomenon arises, it's conditioned. Again, we're seeing that there isn't an instant of permanence in that flow of praticca samutpada. Right? There's never, it's a simultaneous process again. There isn't an instant of permanence in the arising and ceasing of conditions. You could say that there is practically a process of conditions. A dharma is a condition, and dependence on which a dharma arises, but in the very instant it arises, it is a condition. So, the emptiness and condition co-production of praticca samutpada are synonymous. Emptiness and conditioned co-production are two different things. That's important to see that conditionality and emptiness are synonymous. Because ultimately we see that they are the middle way between existence and non-existence. We'll have a look at that, especially if we would do the Nagarjuna's examination. But again, we've got to come back to, you can't have ultimate without conventional. We're existing, conventional is our experience. You can't have the ultimate, the emptiness, without the conventional. So to take one without the other just doesn't make sense.
How do you, the statement all dharmas are empty, which includes conditioned and unconditioned dharmas. So how does that division of conditioned and unconditioned dharmas square with emptiness and particular samatha?
The conditioned and unconditioned dharmas. Well, of course, when we look at it from the point of view of praticca samutpada, there is no separation between conditioned and unconditioned. Unconditioned is only that it's unconditioned by greed, hatred, and delusion.
That's what it is. Okay. So it's the compound and the condition discussion.
Right.
It's the language.
Yes.
It's the language distinction between
yes.
those two things.
The unconditioned. I mean, the Theravadins or the Sathastivadins saw them as being unconditioned, as being separate, the conditioned and the unconditioned. But this is the denial of it. They actually saw it as stopping. You know,
yeah.
If you look at Kunze, he has goes into a rather complicated explanation of
yeah.
it. How they did an analysis of these dharmas and looked at them like those ultimately existent dharmas were either of nirvana or of samsara. Like stopping was both. There's a table somewhere in here. Yeah, the marks. Or he's looking at it from the point of view of the marks, that impermanence is both produced and stopped. Ill is defiled and immaculate. Its impermanence is this world, the conditioned, the relative, the five skandhas and samsaras. The beyond is the unconditioned, the absolute. Emptiness, nirvana. Now,
it's an attack on that.
From the Abhidharmic point of view, they're putting these into being either the conditioned and the unconditioned is the nirvanic. The unconditioned, the conditioned is the world and the unconditioned is nirvanic. And they're stopping. Nirvanic is stopping. And it's also immaculate and it's also complete. You know, when they said these three things, it's Hiroshariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are not produced or stopped, defiled or immaculate, deficient or complete. So they're putting these into either this world or the beyond.
So there's an attack on that distinction.
There's an attack on the distinction. So, Pratitya Samutpada, emptiness, are synonymous. Emptiness is Pratitya Samutpada. Pratitya Samutpada is emptiness. But with that, feeling.
Found that very
helpful. It's that idea, the sort of simultaneity, that there's never that moment of instant, of permanence, with the idea that as a dharma is conditioned, or a phenomenon is a condition, in dependence of which a phenomenon arises, but the very instant it arises, it's a condition.
That's very useful.
Yeah. So there's no degree of permanence in it. It's empty of any substance. There's nothing graspable in there. There's nothing to be attached to. Nothing to cause suffering if you realize, fully realize Pratitya Samutpada. That's when the Buddha told Ananda, it's quite a complex thing, not the simple thing that you were suggesting.
Well, I think that, for me, that points to the fact that there's a sort of tendency to try and simplify and what we see or understand and make it static. So if if I put a piece of toast in a toaster and it cooks, then I think that one thing has arisen, which is toast.
Mm-hmm.
But actually a whole lot of things have arisen, not just toast.
Sure.
The aroma of toast has arisen, which is conditioning somebody's mind to kind of go, oh, toast and saliva is happening, and crumbs are happening, and the deterioration of the element in the toaster is happening, and condensation on the window is happening.
Yeah.
But it's very easy to just think that from A arises B.
That's right.
Which is that from an electrical element arises, and bread arises toast.
Yeah.
And it's much more complex than that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This
is really where my question about relative substantiality comes in, or comparative substantiality. Because I think what we do is we break things down into elements that we can handle as units. And then we neglect the fact that we have a role in that, to create these units that we can then treat as a relative existence. Because they do have relative existence. But because we so habitually treat them in that way, we think that existence is more than it is.
So we break down reality into chunks that we can understand and then describe those chunks as reality.
As real, yes.
So any other questions or points on this from the beginning? This is sort of the heart of seeing into the true nature of that instant of becoming. Its indefinability, its ineffability, and that's how things are. Beginning to see, or get even the feeling that, well, there is nothing fixed at all. There's nothing to cling to. Nothing to hold on to. The idea that, I think I mentioned it yesterday about, someone said to me recently, you can't put your hand in the river in the same place twice. But I immediately thought, no, that's true, but you can't put your hand in the river in the same place once. And that's how things are. That's how everything is. It's not just the river. That's how life is. According to this, that's how the universe is.
Noticing this morning too that I'm much more the ice had melted on the loch, and that's a good description of something constantly changing.
Well, we can observe it, and just about everything is changing. And you mentioned yesterday that a favourite one is a leaf.
Yeah.
in orbit. You can't really put the designation leaf on it. It's much better if you say it's leafing. You know, there's never anything fixed about a leaf from it's a bud till it drops off brown. It's simply a process of leafing.
That is quite a good example, isn't it? I read that before quite recently. I can't remember where I read it. It was like taking a block of ice and then taking water. And you say, is a block of ice and the water the same or are they different? So what is it? Are they the same or are they different? In a way, the argument's a false one, because all you've got is conditions. All you've got is conditions of change from one to the other. That's all you've got.
Yes.
So in a school of thought, they would just say, that's a block of ice, and that's water. They're both completely different. And our school of thought would say, well, they're both exactly the same. But Buddhism would say, no, they're just conditions. And by conditionality, the block of ice turns into water. So not the same or different.
Well, it's the same with kind of rock and sound, you know, it's kind of vibratory frequencies, you know.
You can apply it to anything, can you? You can apply it to anything.
I mean, one way I used to kind of make sense of emptiness is vibration, you know, everything is changing because the vibration's changing, the frequency of vibration, you know. So if you water nice, but water's ice. I think I'm right in saying ice is probably vibrating slower than water because of its fluidity. I could be wrong on that, but it's just an example, you know.
Well, it's heat, isn't it? If you get heat, you get energy. If you get energy, you get movement. When you get heat, you get energy, movement.
But from what we've discussed this morning, you can use a formulation of Pratitya Samutpada for everything. Nothing is excluded from it. There is nothing which isn't dependent. And then that's as true a statement as you can get from what we've been studying. There is nothing which doesn't arise in dependence upon conditions. That's implicit in what we've studied today. Nothing whatsoever that you couldn't put the formulation of Pratitya Samutpada. I mean, obviously the Buddhist ones that are best known are the 12 Nidanas and the Four Noble Truths, but they can apply it to anything. Food, toast, life, birth and death. There is nothing which isn't dependent. So there is nothing which isn't Pratitya Samutpada, arising in dependence upon conditions. There is nothing which isn't Shunya. Suggested third reflection. Reflect that in the flow of phenomena there is no abiding. No degree of permanence whatsoever. You've got it in your list. A permanent phenomena is never produced, never ultimately comes into substantial existence. It exists only by the conventional designation we apply to an object of perception. Its true nature is emptiness, and emptiness is synonymous with Pratitya Samutpada. I suggest that has been quite a good Well, if there's no questions, I'm a bit early, but I've sort of put a mark on my page to say that that's the end of day two.
One sentence.
So anyway, nothing else.
I think you did one sentence.
You did? A whole sentence, but there is the paragraph comes from that. So. Yep. That's great, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you.